Today, I want to call note to certain men in the Bible who made a difference. And they're recorded in history. And these examples are people who held responsible positions in service to their government. These people, these men, were believers in the true God. And many times, their responsibility before God conflicted with their responsibility before the human government that they served. Each of these men were placed in a position of authority. Each of them had to make decisions that could affect their well-being and even their lives. We're going to take a brief look at their lives and see what they had in common that allowed them to persevere to become noted men of history. The title of today's message is Men in the Middle. Men in the Middle. I note that I'm a government employee. I teach high school at a public charter school. And I suspect that you would not be surprised to know that many, if not most, administrators in education and in higher education are anti-God. Many people in education cling to the religion of humanism. They support the ideas of a world without God. They don't adhere to an expectation of righteous behavior as we understand righteous behavior as outlined in the Bible. This humanist behavior, a world without God, directs their expectations of others. So if you believe in God and that the Bible is the Word of God, then they will tolerate you perhaps to a minimal degree. Privately, they will think, well, you're crazy. They even mock Christian morals or standards of righteousness. I'm faced, as many of you would be, with these anti-God situations regularly, even daily. And I got to wondering how ancient biblical characters handled these situations, and somehow they came through it okay. Well, their stories are recorded in the Bible for our benefit. So I'm going to go through a thumbnail sketch of seven biblical characters, all who worked in some governmental capacity as an administration. The first character that I find in Genesis that I'm calling up today is the name of Joseph. Joseph was one of 12 sons of Jacob. Jacob was later renamed Israel. Joseph was a grandson of Isaac and a great-grandson of Abraham, who's known as the father of the faithful. And if you take a look at Joseph in the Bible, let's read it in the book of Genesis 37. I'm not going to go through it verse by verse, but, you know, if you remember the Princess Bride movie where the little boy was sick and Grandpa came in and he said, I'm going to read you a story. And the whole movie was about reading a story. Well, I have grandchildren visiting this weekend, and you can imagine what it's like where Grandpa, come up and tell me a story. So, as you might imagine, one story isn't good enough, because as soon as you're done with one story, it's, tell me another one. Two isn't enough, and tell me another one. So today you're going to get seven stories. So we're going to give these seven thumbnail sketches, because Grandpa's going to tell a story. In Genesis 37, we read about this Joseph. We read about this one of 12 sons of Jacob, also called Israel. And we read that he was a favored son of his father, that his father made him a coat of many colors. Now, if we stop and evaluate that alone, how difficult that would be. Imagine that you had to make everything yourself in a more subsistence economy. How do you make a coat of more than one color, much less two or three or more? That takes substantial effort. You have to collect the information and the materials, the technology, in order to be able to do that. And when one child is favored with that, what did the 10 older brothers did not think well then of the favored child? And so we have this, there's a level of resentment that grew in. And of course, Joseph had dreams that one day his brothers would bow down to him. And I can only imagine what that would have been like if we were one of the elder siblings and the younger one says, you know, someday, basically, you're all going to be bowing to me. And you look at the little rascal. Sure, buddy, sure. I mean, just, you know, there's just not going to compute too well right off the bat that this can't possibly be so. So you have Joseph, and yet his vision was true. It was of the future. The dream told of the future. So what did the brothers do? The brothers found him, bound him, and threw him in a pit, and then said, what shall we do with this troublemaker? And if we read through Genesis 37, some of them were inclined to just kill him. But the eldest brother Reuben says, you know, let's think about this. Let's talk about it. And brother Judah says, you know, if we sell him to our cousins, he'll be gone and we can make some money on the side. So we got two problems. You know, we've got money and we've got rid of the problem child. So that's what they did. They sold him to the Ishmaelites, their cousins, who were traders on the caravan. Caravan went on through to Egypt. And they sold him. Basically, he was a chattel slave. He was owned by somebody. And now, what did they tell their father? Oh, here's the coat. It's got blood on it. The wild animal must have got him, blah, blah, blah. Well, wound up with a story to pacify their father that it was, you know, to show that they didn't have guilt themselves. So you have Joseph in Egypt, not by his plan. It's not like saying, you know what, I think I want to go to college in Egypt. I'm about 17 and this is time for me to, you know, sprout wings and fly away from home. No, he found himself as a servant in Egypt and through a variety or through a circumstances found himself confronted with a big lie that he had attempted to accost his master's wife, which he refused to do, and yet he was accused and basically convicted of anyway and thrown into prison. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever visited prisons. I've had an opportunity to see some, in here and in Europe, and they're not pretty places. If you take a look, I know in the ancient prisons, rats abounded. I don't know about the modern ones. I don't know that they have a rodent issue. But it's like we read even as recently as 100 to 200 years ago that the rats in some prisons were the only meat that the prisoners ate. So it gives you an idea of how difficult and unsanitary it was. And I'm sure Joseph wasn't having a pleasant circumstance either. And yet, again, Joseph had dreams. He was able to interpret the butcher, or the baker, and the Pharaoh's cupbearer's dreams, and they came true. It was a remarkable thing. And Joseph then had an opportunity to interpret the Pharaoh's dreams. And the Pharaoh had dreams about seven fat cows being eaten up by seven skinny cows and so forth. And we have those, and one of Pharaoh's freed former prisoners said, well, go to Joseph. He can tell you about this. It was true with me. And the Pharaoh did and brought Joseph out of prison and said, tell me the dream. And Joseph, now a young man, clearly a young man, explained the dream to Pharaoh that they would have seven good years. And the seven good years would be followed by seven famine years. And if they planned accordingly for the seven good years, they could be prepared for the seven bad years. Now, to understand that fully, one must understand the situation in Egypt. Egypt is a long strip of a country around immediately adjacent to the Nile River. You get a mile on either side and you're looking at desert. We're talking sand and rocks. So it's really a strip that runs along the Nile River. Doesn't have a lot of rain in Egypt, but the rain is up in the Ethiopia and it flows north on the Nile through Egypt, and they rely on flooding and irrigation for that. But what happens if it doesn't rain upstream? The river dries up. They can't do their irrigation. If you've seen some of the ancient irrigation, they're still using some of the same methods where they have a device that dips the water out of the river and the water flows back on the device and flows into a ditch. It's an ancient pump style, and they are able to irrigate their crops. Even today, Egypt produces a lot of cotton using irrigation. So Joseph was saying, you know, you really should prepare. And if you set aside a certain portion of the crop each year and make it mandatory, Egypt will be fine. And the Pharaoh was so impressed with the young man's perception and interpretation that he put him in charge of the project. And that Joseph then rose to be the second in command of all of Egypt, one of the biggest empires in the world, which is astounding. You have a boy, and I'm going to guess 17, maybe younger, in a pit in what is in Canaan, in the land of Canaan, despised of his brothers, somehow sold, loaded on a camel, trussed up like a hog, sent off to Egypt, thrown, becoming a servant, thrown into prison under false accusations. But he maintained his faithfulness and his dignity by refusing his master's wife who accosted him. And so he had a value system. Where do you suppose he got that value system? Well, I would suggest under Genesis 37 that he got it through his father, who got it from his grandfather. And if you take a look at Isaac's, through Joseph's father was Jacob, his father was Isaac, his grandfather was Abraham, that there had to be family teachings of what a strong value, and those teachings had to adhere to Joseph. And so he stuck with it. He was determined that he wasn't going to mess up his life, even though he was under great adversity. I don't know what it's like to be in a pit. I hope to never know. I don't know what it's like to be thrown into prison. I hope I never know. Those circumstances had to be trying for him. And yet all of that, he didn't bend to the temptations for sin. And then an unusual occurrence happened. There was a famine in the land of Canaan. And Jacob's and 70 of his descendants all came to Egypt. They didn't know Joseph. They didn't know him because he would have been dressed like an Egyptian. So when they came, Joseph knew them, but they did not know Joseph. So if we take a look at this, now is the perfect opportunity to take vengeance on the 10 older brothers and to put it to them. He's gone through utter misery in the pit and then in as a slave and then in prison. And yet what did he do? He was gracious with his brothers. And so we have, if we want to remember the life of Joseph, we can do it with the letter P. First, he was thrown in a pit. Then he went to Potiphar's house. Then he went to prison. Then he went to Pharaoh's court. And ultimately, we will read, when he left Egypt, he had died. They carried him out in what I would call a pine box. They put him in a coffin, embalmed him, and carried him out. So the letter P will help you remember the entirety of Joseph's life. And it was recorded in Genesis 37 as to how he maintained his dignity before God, did not take vengeance on his brothers. And that was recorded for our benefit. And his bones were then taken back to the land of Canaan for burial. Now, it was 400 and some years later that there's another character that shows up in the Bible in Exodus 2. The word Exodus means to depart, to leave. You may have heard of this name before. His name is Moses. Moses is mentioned about 800 times in the Bible. There's only one person that has mentioned more times, and that's David. So, that's a lot of mentions for one person. Moses was the oldest member of the tribe of Levi. And if we read through the life of Moses, we know that he had an older brother, Aaron, and an older sister, Miriam. Now, I have an older brother. I don't have an older sister. Some people have older siblings. And when you're the younger sibling, just ask Joseph. It isn't always an easy circumstance. But Moses was adopted out forcibly as a baby. Apparently, his older sister was looking after him while he was the Pharaoh wanted to kill all the Hebrew babies at that time. And Pharaoh's niece found Moses in a basket in the river and didn't have children of her own, so she adopted this beautiful baby. And so this beautiful baby then grew up as part of in Pharaoh's court. He grew up a prince in Egypt. Wonder what it would be like if any of us were snatched up, put in a royal household, and given the best of everything. We're talking the best clothing. We're talking the best food. We're talking the best education. All of the relationships right seated at the money and power of the biggest, strongest government on the face of the earth. And he was right there. He became a military commander, experienced in foreign accomplishments in the military. And Moses' life can be divided into three portions of 40. And if we read through the first 40 years, he was spent in Pharaoh's court. He was learning what he needed to know about government, about military, about administration. But he also came to know that he was actually a Hebrew baby. Back at work at school for the last couple of days and going through professional development. And the subject among several teachers was their DNA testing. And a teacher I was sitting at the same table at, she says, you know, I've never done it, but I really have no idea. I'm adopted, and I don't have any idea of my heritage. But as soon as she would do that, and I'm going to guess she's 40-ish or something, she says, but as soon as I do, it's going to reveal probably a lot of things in a lot of directions. I don't think that they had DNA testing in Moses' day. But by the time he was 40, it may have been obvious that he didn't look like them, like the regular Egyptians. He looked more like those Hebrew people over there. And at some point, and you know, what kid didn't look in the mirror and say, you know, after a rough episode with the parents and say, am I really part of this family or did they pick me up off a street corner somewhere? And so, at some point, he had to come to the realization that he was a Hebrew baby and had grown up there as an adopted child. And at that time, at 40, he then found, now he was a part of Pharaoh's court, a favored royal, and he found someone mistreating one of the Hebrew people. Now, when we say mistreating, we don't mean somebody snubbing somebody, saying a cross word to them, because mistreating could be very brutal. That means with whips and other punishments. I don't know if any of you have ever caught in the sting of the whip. You might try it on yourself sometime just to know what it's like, and you don't want it anymore. And the anger in Moses welled up, and he killed the Egyptian overlord and buried him in the sand. But he was seen. He was seen by a Hebrew. And it was shortly after, when he was correcting one of the Hebrews, and they said, what are you going to do? You're going to kill me like you did the Egyptian? Ooh. So now Moses knew the issue was known. It was known. And he also knew that because he was a native Hebrew and he killed an Egyptian official, his life could be forfeit in an instant. So he fled and he left. And so this was the first 40 years. And so we then look at the next 40 years of Moses' life. And the next 40 years, Moses then lived in the desert, learning to do what? Be a shepherd. What does a shepherd have to do? They guide sheep. They protect them from things that could hurt them. He got married. He had a couple of sons. He took advice from his father-in-law, Jethro, about organization, who somehow knew these things over years. And so if we take a look through the life of Moses, that 40 years was his training in the wilderness, as it were, his training in the desert, learning to be a shepherd. And it was then that God called Moses to a specific task. And that specific task was the burning bush incident. And this burning bush incident, where God gave instructions to Moses to lead the Hebrew people out of Egypt. And Moses had the usual question, had any of us been on that same mountain and the burning bush? Now, you got my attention with a bush that burns but doesn't burn up. I mean, that's pretty awesome right there. And it was the, why me, Lord? Okay, can't you pick somebody more qualified? Somebody else that can maybe, you know, carry out this task. But he was tasked with this to be able to do it. And yet Moses knew that when he went back to Egypt, his life could be forfeit. So he would have to walk into the mouth of the lion. And then do something unthinkable. Tell the Pharaoh to let the Hebrew people go. Well, who wants to let your moneymaker go? If they're working for the Pharaoh, you have anywhere from 1 million to 2 million people, and they are your servants. That's a big task. And it's unrealistic to think that the Pharaoh would just say, oh, yeah, you know what? We've messed with you for over 400 years. It's probably time. Why don't you just go ahead and go your way? Here, let's pay you umpty millions in wages, and you can go your way. It didn't come that easy. And we hear the story of the 10 plagues to convince Pharaoh. And when Moses, and we recover this every spring in before the spring holidays, when Moses led the children of Israel out of Egypt, there were a series of impossible tasks and traps. How to get out of the traps. And all of those, they could have lost at any one time. Moses, the leaders would have all died. The people could have been indiscriminately slaughtered, herded back to Egypt at any time. And yet, Moses said, you know, see the deliverance of the Lord. And they did. They were able to cross the Red Sea. And then something really quite interesting happened. What happened with Moses in the desert was a codification of the Ten Commandments. Now, did they know the Ten Commandments? Oh, yeah. They had to have known them since they were established at creation. We know the Sabbath was established there, and we know that commandment against murder was there. We have no reason to think that the other commandments were not also well known at that time. But now the finger of God carved them on a stone on Mount Sinai. Wasn't on paper. Wasn't on your iPad. It was in stone that would last. And this then was placed into an Ark of the Covenant, and the items placed in that ark were the staff of Aaron. They were fed in the desert manna, so there was a bowl of manna. There were the stone tablets, and then they went on to the Promised Land. God promised them freedom. Let's go back. So what do we have now? This opportunity then to go to the Promised Land. And so we have this occasion where Moses then took the people of Israel across. Now, were they helpful, kind, considerate people, as we read and throughout Exodus? In fact, I'd like to turn to the difficulty that Moses had in leading the people. If we turn to Exodus 34 in verses 6 and 7. Exodus 34, verses 6 and 7. The Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands, and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. Moses was calling attention to this, that he saw a great God that was, because God had every reason to be angry for all of these ungrateful, stiff-necked Israelites. And yet he recognized that these characteristics of God are things that we should also adopt. Now, and it's interesting, too, that we read in Deuteronomy 34, at verse 7, that Moses was 120 years old and they died, and he was buried in secret. What do you suppose would have happened if he would have been one of the most commented people on in the Bible? What do you suppose people would have done with his tomb or his grave? They would have made a shrine out of it. And Moses would be the one, and not God, that would be the one that was honored. And so if we read Deuteronomy 34 and verses 4 and 5, they buried him in Moab, but to this day no one knows where his grave is. Somewhere out there, several thousand years ago. Now there's a story that goes on in the same time, and this is the third character, and his name is Caleb. And Caleb, we can read about in Numbers 13 and 14, and then in Numbers 32 and 34. Now Caleb, I remember the first time I heard the name, I was a kid, and then there was another kid that was about my age named Caleb, and I thought, I think that's a name in the Bible. So I remember as a kid, I went and looked it up. Yeah, I've seen that name before, that somebody had named their child Caleb. Caleb was one of Moses' close servants and a close associate with Joshua. Caleb was one of those, when the children of Israel left Egypt, he was one of those that was sent to spy out the land, and he and Joshua went together, and they spied out the promised land to Canaan, and he rose to prominence as a young man, was appointed chief of the tribe of Judah, according to Jewish history books. And by all evidence, he remained loyal to God and to Moses, even when 10 of the other spies said it couldn't be done. The land of Canaan could not be taken over. Caleb and Joshua stood up and said, God says we can do this, so we can do this. So let's do it. But of course, because the other 10 said not, God said, okay, if you don't want to go, you can be another 40 years in the desert until everybody over 20 dies off, which has got to be a tough thing to be. It's a life sentence to live in the desert. So, and Joshua and Caleb, they explored Canaan for 40 days. It wasn't like they just went and took a look over the hill. Now, I was gone for 2 weeks. And now imagine 40 days. What do you have to pack for 40 days? Money? Food? Clothing? Backpack of some kind? Shelter? What are you going to do? Wolves? Lions? Bear? Bad people? That's why they went in pairs. But 40 days. And they saw and heard all the tales of big, strong cities with big walls, giants, and an unforgiving land in it, what they termed as a land that eats its inhabitants. Well, they worship Molech, where they put babies on arms and slid them alive into fires. This was anathema. It was terrible for the children of Israel. And they thought, we're going to be their next victims. The men and the women will be taken as slaves, and the children, the men will just be murdered. He won't even take them, just keep the women and children. But what did Caleb say specifically? If we take a look at his words, we can surely go up and take possession of it, for we can indeed overcome it. The land we pass through to scout is an exceedingly good land if the Lord desires us. He will bring us to this land and give it to us, a land flowing with milk and honey. But you shall not rebel against the Lord, and you will not fear the Lord, the people of the land, for they are as our bread. Their protection is removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Don't fear them. And yet the people of Israel feared them anyway. Well, as a result, all the adults never did enter Israel. It was the next generation after 40 years in the desert. So we have Caleb, that example of him who was working actively in the Israel government, as it were, as an assistant to Moses, and yet maintained his faithfulness to God and faithfulness to Moses. The fourth character we have is Nehemiah. And there's a book in the Bible named after Nehemiah. Nehemiah was a captive taken from Judah off to a land east of that, in what is now the area of Iran, Iraq. And he became a cupbearer to King Artaxerxes. Now, Nehemiah had the job of a cupbearer. Now, this doesn't mean just running and fetching a cup of coffee or lemonade for the king or a glass of wine. It meant he had to take a first drink of it. And who better, if you want an enemy, if you're worried about enemies conspiring to poison you, have the enemy take the first bite. Have the enemy take the first drink. And he was a child of the land of Israel, of Judah. And so he was a cupbearer to the king. So he, in front of the king, would have to partake of it. And who's the first one to die if somebody's going to poison the king? Which was apparently a common way for people to go. I think I read somewhere that there were, 9 popes that were poisoned over the years. So this was a common way to get rid of people who were in charge of something. Probably still is. I don't know. I'm not in that business. But Nehemiah had a very responsible job. And because he was so close to King Artaxerxes, you suppose they ever talk much? They ever chat about the weather? Nice day today? I think they talked about other things. And they noted that, Nehemiah, why are you sad? Because back in Judea, my homeland, the walls of the city are broken down. There's no safety for the people, the animals, and the people that besiege them run wild. Nehemiah, you might say, was a man who cried out to God. He wasn't a preacher. He wasn't a pastor. There's no indication he ever went to church. Now, he was just a Jewish cupbearer to King Artaxerxes in what is today in the city of Susa, what is today's Iran or Persia. So he could have just stayed in his comfortable position, live in a nice palace, everything was fine, but his heart rended for his homeland. And he received the reports because the king was receiving the reports and he was right there. He could see these things. And so we read, we open up the book of Nehemiah. It's about the distress that Jerusalem is in. The walls are broken, the gates have been burned. And Nehemiah weeps for his people, and he cries out to God for mercy. I presume that most of us have had an opportunity to weep and to cry to God for mercy. Nehemiah did too. But he was a man who was serving in a secular government. But he identified with his own people in Israel who were suffering. And because the king trusted him, he was so close to the king and developed that positive relationship. The king appointed Nehemiah as to be the new governor of that conquered territory. And that new governor then gave him a letter that said, here's Nehemiah, you're going to be the new governor. You can use the king's forest and all of the king's resources to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem and rebuild the gates. Because you just can't go take try that today. Go out to a national park, get out your chainsaw, bring her out to your truck, and start whacking down a few trees and see what happens if somebody with a badge comes up and doesn't visit you. Nehemiah had the authority. He had the permit in his hand to be able to do that. And it wasn't a small thing. As we read in Nehemiah, He rebuilt the walls despite great opposition. And then in Nehemiah 7, he gathered the people and listed them according to genealogy, and then had God's word read to them by Ezra the priest in Nehemiah 8. So we have this finishing the walls, putting some around Jerusalem. And working with Ezra the priest, he worked to bring the people back to God. And if we read Nehemiah 8 in verse 9, and Nehemiah, who was the governor, Ezra the priest and scribe, and the Levites who taught the people said to all, "This day is holy to the Lord your God. Do not mourn or weep." For the people wept when they heard the words of the law. It was the Sabbath day, and they were being read the law. And Nehemiah 13 gives the description of what happens when he had finished the wall. And in Nehemiah 13, "In those days, I saw people in Judah treading wine presses on the Sabbath, taking stomping grapes, and bringing in sheaves, harvesting grain, loading donkeys with wine, grapes, figs, and all kinds of burdens. They were pursuing their livelihoods, which they brought to Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. And I warned them about the day in which they were selling provisions, and the men of Tyre dwelt there also," that's on the Mediterranean Sea, on the coast, "who brought in fish and all kinds of good and sold them on the Sabbath to the children of Judah and Jerusalem. And I contended with the nobles of Judah," the people that were allowing this. And he said, "What evil thing is this that you do, by which you profane the Sabbath?" Verse 18, "Did not your fathers do this," meaning your ancestors, "and did not our God bring all this disaster on us and on this city?" In other words, the city was captured, the walls were broken, the gates were burned, and we were hauled off to another land. "Yet you bring added wrath on Israel by profaning the Sabbath." Verse 19, "So it was at the gates of Jerusalem, it began to be dark before Sabbath. I," meaning Nehemiah, "commanded the gates to be shut and charged that they must not be opened until after the Sabbath. And I posted some of my servants at the gates, so no burdens would be brought in on the Sabbath. Now the merchants and sellers of all kinds of wares lodged outside of Jerusalem once or twice." Well, they didn't get in to go to the motel. Gates are closed. They had a journey, and there was no well, no place to refresh themselves. And so, what does Nehemiah say? Verse 21, "Then I warned them and said, 'Why do you spend the night around the wall? If you do so again, I will lay hands on you.'" In other words, force them to go away. "From that time on, they came no more on the Sabbath. And I commanded the Levites they should cleanse themselves, they should go and guard the gates to sanctify the Sabbath day." So we have Nehemiah. Number four is Nehemiah, who who wasn't a priest, and yet he was instrumental in becoming a secular governor to help to enforce the re-instruction of the laws of God to the people in Judah. The fifth character, the fifth example we have, you may have heard of the name of Daniel, whole book of Daniel. Daniel was a young Jewish prince from Israel. And if we take a look at his history, he became, from a young man on, a counselor to three emperors, Nebuchadnezzar, Cyrus, and Darius, or Darius. Now, the word Daniel means "God is my judge," in Hebrew. But when the Babylonians captured him, they changed his name to Belteshazzar, which in the meaning of that one was "May God protect his life." As a young man, Daniel was trained in the king's court. He had to set the example and established a reputation to be intelligent and for faithfulness to his God. Early on in his training, they wanted him to eat the king's rich food and wine, and we suspect then it was unclean because David would need it. But Daniel and his friends Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they wanted just vegetables and water instead, and they wound up to be healthier than others and were allowed to continue then a friendly diet that was biblical. God then, after these tests, gave Daniel the ability to interpret visions and dreams. And before long, then Daniel was explaining the dreams of Nebuchadnezzar. But Daniel was given wisdom by God, and Daniel was conscientious in his work, such that he served during reigns of successive rulers. How many people have that opportunity? Doesn't happen too often. Well, you've served one emperor, and now there's a new one comes in. Well, you serve that one, and then a new one comes in. Usually they wipe out everybody from the previous or purge them. Yet Daniel was so well thought of that he served three emperors over 70 years. Now, of course, some of us know the story about Daniel being faithful and being thrown in the lion's den because he was faithful to God and refused to worship human rulers, humans, in place of God. But Daniel then was a model of faith, and we could say that he was also a prophet because of the prophecies of Daniel that we have with us today. He survived Daniel's the lion's den because of his faith in God, and he predicted the future triumph of the Messiah and the development of the kingdom in the kingdom of God in Daniel 7 through chapter 7 through 12. So from Daniel, we have references to him throughout the Bible, but he was also known as an advisor, an administrator, a prophet, but certainly dedicated to God. The sixth character that we have a thumbnail sketch of is Mordecai. We read about him in the book of Esther. Now, Mordecai, again, was a Jew who was taken off to Persia. We call it Iran. And he served King Xerxes. And King Xerxes, spelled with an X, served the king. And his uncle's daughter, as it read, was Esther. The Hebrew name was Hadassah. And it said she had neither father nor mother. It doesn't say what happened to her father and mother, but this was not a surprise. I presume there were many blended family situations that were dragged off to another world. It says when her mother and father died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So it was an older cousin and a younger cousin. We read that in Esther 2:7. So Mordecai became the parent of this. And Esther was apparently a lovely young lady who the king then picked as a new queen when he held the beauty contest for the new queen. And yet, when we read Esther 2:11, what did Mordecai do? He paced in front of the court of the women's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her. He didn't stop being the parent. He was the dad, as it were, looking after his little girl and showing compassion. And now what happens is that there was an episode where all the Jews were subject to be killed then in Persia. And he was the one that urged Esther to do something. You can't just sit on your hands and do nothing. Now, Mordecai knew that if Esther didn't do something and she was in a position to be able to do something, that all Jews would be at risk. And we now know from history that the Jews being at risk is a very real thing. In the 1930s and 40s, over 6 million Jews were killed in Europe. Over half of the Jews in Europe were killed at that time. Throughout the Middle Ages, during the Black Plague, entire villages of Jews were wiped out, such that many of the Jews in the Middle Ages fled to Eastern Europe to get out of Western Europe to be safe. So the Jews have been targeted for a long time, and they were then targeted back there in Persia. And it was through Mordecai's influence and instruction that Esther was able then to be able to help the Jews defend themselves and mute the opposition against them. Now, who is this Mordecai? I mean, it tells us that Mordecai was in the king's gate, meaning he had responsibility in the government. And Mordecai was paying attention when he found out that in Esther 2, verses 21 and 22, that there was a plot to kill the king. Well, he should be okay with that, right? He's a kind of a captive. But he informed the king and said, your life is at risk. This elevated then Mordecai in the eyes of the king. So Mordecai had the wisdom to read the situation, to know when to act, and how then to best protect the life of the king, because the life of the king would have protected him. Mordecai was proud of his heritage, and so he had an opportunity then to protect his people, given his relationships, the benefit of his relationship with the king. He had some trust with the king and his influence over Esther. And so we have this example then of Mordecai, who was standing up for what was right under difficult circumstances, working for a secular ruler. Then we take a look, and we're going to go on to Acts 10, and we're going to go to number 7, and we have a fellow by the name of Cornelius. This is the 7th and the last one, Cornelius. Cornelius, we read about in Acts 10, was a Roman centurion. He was a Roman army officer in charge of 100 men. Of the record, he was one of the first, if not the first, Gentile converts to Christianity. Cornelius, as a Roman soldier, recognized God's calling, and he was determined to follow God's way despite at the great personal risk to himself. It's not always popular to be a Christian. It was many years ago. I was named with a particular fellowship to university, and I had the banquet and this fellowship as a midlife career changer. And my application to graduate school was turned down. I have the rejection letter still. I've taped it to the back of my graduate diploma. And I asked, well, why is this? It's this letter said, you don't have an undergraduate degree. You don't have enough credits for an undergraduate degree. And this is a graduate program. So basically, don't come knocking on this door. And I went and asked a professor about it. And I said, how can this be? Everything is in order. I've got everything, all of my undergraduate degree, my diploma, my transcript, it's all right there on the computer on university records. And he said, it appears the guy making the decision didn't look past the first page, and all of your data is summarized on the last page. So I wrote an appeal. Never heard anything on appeal. So again, I asked a mentor professor, how could this be? I said, is it because the professor making the decision is from Lebanon and is of a very different religion and my undergraduate degree is from a Baptist university? And he looked at me and smiled and he said, could be, probably. The discrimination was right there, that I was not being admitted because the name of the university, Bethel University, where I had graduated from, stood out like a sore thumb to the Muslim professor who was denying me entrance, not based on qualification. But where God, sometimes there's a door closed, sometimes there's a window that's open. And so I crawled through a different window, got a different program, made use of the opportunity, and ta-da, worked out even better. Couldn't have known that at the time. It was a hard thing. So I'm looking at these people, just like the Roman centurion Cornelius. You never know what bad thing can happen if you identify yourself as a Christian. So who have we looked at? These 7 men in the middle. We've looked at Joseph in Genesis 37, the ruler of all Egypt immediately under Pharaoh. We looked at Moses in Exodus 2, raised as a prince of Egypt and claimed his Hebrew heritage. We looked at Caleb In Numbers 13 and 14 and 32 to 34, he was assistant to Moses, and Joshua was one of the spies in Canaan. He had the courage to stand up and claim the promised land despite going against the crowd. And then we looked at Nehemiah. In the book of Nehemiah, who worked for the Persian emperor, then became a governor of Judah and rebuilt the walls of Jerusalem and helped re-educate and re-establish the Sabbath. We looked at Daniel. The book of Daniel, a Jewish prince, worked in government for 70 years under three different emperors or administrations and was critical with regard to administration of the empire and of his public adherence to God's ways and the prophecies that he was entrusted to write down. Sixth, we looked at Mordecai in the book of Esther, who worked for the king. He was instrumental in rescuing the Jewish people from extermination through his influence with the king and with Esther. And then we looked at Cornelius in Acts 10, an early Gentile convert, despite working as a Roman army officer. So, what did we learn from these examples? Let's take a look at Micah 6:8. In Micah 6:8, each of these people had to demonstrate the characteristics that are in Micah 6:8. And Micah 6:8 reads simply, "He has shown you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God?" And each of these characters displayed that expectation. Then I'd like you to turn to Deuteronomy 6. Deuteronomy 6 in verse 20. In Deuteronomy 6 in verse 20. "When your son asks you in time to come, saying, 'What is the meaning of the testimonies, the statutes, and the judgments which the Lord our God has commanded you?' Then you shall say to your son, 'We were slaves of Pharaoh in Egypt, and Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. And the Lord showed signs and wonders before our eyes, great and severe, against Egypt, Pharaoh, and all his household. For our application, you might say, we were slaves to sin, and God brought us out of sin.'" Verse 23, "Then he brought us out from there that he might bring us in to give us the land to which he swore to our fathers," bringing them to the promised land. What's our promised land? God has promised us the kingdom of God. Verse 24, "Then the Lord commanded us to observe all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God for our good always, that he might preserve us alive as it is this day. Then it will be righteousness for us if we are careful to observe all these commandments before the Lord our God as he has commanded us." And let's close out with Deuteronomy 30. In Deuteronomy 30, starting in verse 15. We are left today with the examples of these seven men in the middle. They were stuck in a governmental administrative positions and yet wanting to do their duty before God. And so if we turn to Deuteronomy 30, starting in verse 15, they each had choices to make. So let's start in verse 15. "See, I have set before you today life and good, death and evil, in that I command you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to keep his commandments, his statutes, his judgments, that you may live and multiply. The Lord your God will bless you in the land which you go to possess. But if your heart turns away so that you do not hear and are drawn away and worship other gods and serve them, I announce to you today that you shall surely perish. You shall not prolong your days in the land which you cross over the Jordan to go in and possess. I call heaven and earth as witnesses against you today. I've set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore choose life, that both you and your descendants may live." And this is really the story of these seven men in the middle, where they had the choices laid before them, and they decided to follow the instructions that we read in Micah 6:8, to do justly, love mercy, walk humbly with their God, as we read in Deuteronomy 30 and Deuteronomy 6, to follow God's commandments. And Deuteronomy 30 then would be to choose life.